sense people. And so one of the things that, one of the really fabulous, exciting things that our Dr. Nicoletta Ferone was doing last year in this process was, or maybe it was the year before, but putting electrodes into the brains of the ticks to see how they respond to different stimuli.
Wow.
And so we've done loads of work for quite some time that has contributed again to like understanding how the Haller's organs work on the front legs and also how the natural ingredients that we're interested in impact ticks in general. So yeah, it's there's a lot in there. It's really fascinating stuff. And I think from it, we've learned so much that we can actually develop these really great new products, as well as help other people to understand how they're at risk around ticks. So, you know, a lot of what we do with Atlantic is try to educate the public. Because we, even though Lyme is really, you know, prominent in our own lives, we know that it's really not in the face of everybody across the country. And we think it should be, because we know it's, what's the word I'm looking for? Indiscriminate. Ticks, they'll bite anybody. Anybody who has a blood meal ready for them and that they can access at the, you know, in the moment that they're questing on the top of the blade of grass or whatever short vegetation that they're on, they're going to go for the same things every time. So if we know that, we can help people prepare themselves to prevent those interactions. We like to tell people always to wear, I mean, I know this is not the most comfortable idea on a hot day, but the more you can keep covered, the better. You know, closed-toed shoes, things like that. These are some really basic safety tips, but they're very, very important. Not going off trail into really overgrown areas. Ticks are really temperature specific in that they still need some moisture to be alive. They don't like super, super hot areas, so they probably won't go to like the middle of the lawn where it's mowed, where grass is mowed down, and they would be more exposed. So they tend to hide in areas that are a little bit more moist, shady, and certainly overgrown. You know, so we say keep on trails, be vigilant around your wood piles, things like that. But be aware also that they are attracted by scent. Scent is their primary hunting tool. So, and they're like Lisa said, they're looking for CO2, which is why children and dogs, or, you know, animals are often the population that seems to acquire the tick bites the most, because they're shorter, they're breathing right into the areas, and they're rambunctious, right? They're running off trail, they're running all over the place into the areas that they might more likely encounter ticks.
Yeah, well, it's great that really the research is not only looking at the physiology, but also the behavior of the ticks, as well as, you know, different habitats. And I think I remember reading in one of them that, you know, that they're sort of looking at the difference between, like, is there a difference between testing ticks on humans versus man-made, you know, surfaces? Like, a tick crawling up a leg is going to be different than a tick crawling up, like, a glass plate in the lab or something like that.
Absolutely. And I mean, it is also important to know that part of the product development that we do, it does incorporate an element of human trials, right? Mm-hmm. So in order for us to prove that these things are effective, we have to test them on humans. And so those are controlled tests that are always, like, you know, passed through ethics boards to make sure we're doing things appropriately.
Of course.
But absolutely. No, we've got some seriously brave volunteers. Of course, we use completely clean. But of the species that we're looking at, multiple species, typically, as specifically black-legged or Ixodes, scapularis, but absolutely we look at the dog tick as well. It's another really prominent one across the country that does spread Rocky Mountain spotted fever and a lot of other things that are quite detrimental. And I, if I could take a second and just say,
yeah, of course,
we are absolutely aware. I mean, I've had Lyme, my son, it's, you know, this is personal Lyme, but we've also dealt with co-infections of Lyme. So
exactly,
it's one of those things that you may not know about until you end up having a case of Lyme. But typically, if you're going to be bitten by a tick and acquire one of these things, it's usually not on its own. The pathogens are often bundled. And so we are trying to help people not just avoid Lyme, but avoid up to, I think, 18, 20 pathogens at this point that can be quite detrimental.
Absolutely. Now, I know that essential oils are the main ingredients you're using in your products, which is great to have a natural alternative to synthetics. And what are some of the active ingredients? Or maybe you can tell our listeners, I don't know, about terpenes or about, you know, some of the essential oils like lemongrass or geranium that you've been using in your products.
Well, it is the terpenes in particular. Those are the basically the scent molecules in essential oils. And you know, they break down into different varieties of their own, and those, and they all have different properties. But essential oils are, and the ones that we're looking at, which are very basically obnoxious, the most incredibly obnoxious smell for a tick. They're actually beautiful smells for us,
right?
humans, but for a tick, they are the exact smells that cause them to basically recoil, and they will, it creates a barrier between you and the tick, a scent barrier that ticks are absolutely not willing to cross. But it is the terpenes that create those scents, and the oils that we look at are ones that are known to have particularly effective tick and other insect repellency properties.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And lemon eucalyptus. That was another one I saw in the research.
Exactly. Yeah. And they do often tend to fall in that sort of that more, I wasn't going to say pungent. It's very powerful. They're very, very strong smells, and they often fall into the more antiseptic kind of category of smells for essential oils. Yeah.
And then I just remember I was a tree planter in my 20s. I remember being out in the woods and we smothered ourselves in DEET because that was the only thing back then. And we all knew how toxic it was, and yet we would put it all over our clothing and then, you know, not wash your hands before eating meals. And anyways, for tree planters out there, I hope they're listening to this so they know that there's another option too. And I just think it's great for children and animals and the planet to have better options like this that are not having long-lasting toxic impacts on us all.
Absolutely, Sarah. And if I could just say one more thing, that's a really big differentiator between what we're doing and the DEET-based products that are out there. I know that DEET-based products are, you know, the old standard for repellency with both, you know, the American and the Canadian federal governments. But at this point, there's so many other impacts that are just not, that are just so destructive, like the fact that it's on pretty much every water surface in the around the planet, you know, things like that. But what people also don't know is that DEET itself is degrades plastic. And so any polymer, if you're spraying DEET over yourself to keep anything away, and then you have, for example, like polyester in your clothing, or you're wearing, you have camping gear that has anything that has got a polymer in it, or safety gear at work. We have folks who are, you know, out working on power lines.
Sure.
And they're putting DEET over themselves. And because they have DEET just on their bodies, being in proximity of the power lines, it is melting the rubber coating on the power lines. It's melting fabrics and clothing. It's melting all kinds of safety and general gear. So it's it is an actual problem in that I think in a lot of cases, people think they're safer than they are.
Right.
With DEET, but it also is creating sort of another, you know, environmental catastrophe at the same time. Personally.
I get it. I think I'm still detoxing from it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we'll wrap up this interview, but do either of you have any closing comments for our listeners, especially for parents out there wanting to make sure whether they're parents of children or animals? Any closing comments for them?
I think I would say basically just it's important you protect yourself. It might be a bit of a pain in the butt to spray yourself before you go out or try to remember to spray your dog, et cetera, but it's a heck of a lot easier than having to deal with Lyme.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Ticks don't discriminate. So you need to make sure you're being vigilant. And everybody is at risk. And we have seen cases across the country. So I would say, yeah, be vigilant every day. Do your daily tick checks.
I think those are awesome closing comments. Thank you both so much for your time. Thank you for your determination and seeing this through and making sure that, you know, the science is getting published. And I just hope you continue to have more people coming in and feeding the synergy of your whole project. Congratulations on your hard work.
Thank you. And thank you so much for spreading the word.
Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you, ladies. I loved learning about the evolving scientific research and also that great message that ticks don't discriminate, so be vigilant. This is Looking at Lyme, a podcast of the Canadian Lyme Disease Foundation, and I am your host, Sarah Cormode. Stay safe in the outdoors.
Like a rose in a fire, and you watch it burn. There's a lot to admire in the cold, in the breeze. When the winter takes its toll, you are there, my mind is quiet, and
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 21st to the 25th. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring genre-defying indie alternative artist Barty Strange as guest curator, garage rock chameleons Osays, Chicago-based indie rock three-piece Dead, Latin folk innovator Helada Negro, Toronto's viral hip-hop sensation Akintoye, gothic folk artist Emma Ruth Rundle, alternative R&B hip-hop artist Amindi, and plus many more. There's 150 artists yet to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
When we think of music festivals today, we still find ourselves married to this image of Woodstock. We have open fields, big stages, thousands of people probably suffering from questionable hygienic choices, and lots of booze and drugs. And to be honest, not much has changed. If anything, the idea of a music festival has been streamlined into a rite of passage for young adults. Coachella, into Sasquatch, into Sled Island, into Pemberton, there's just so many choices. And they're all big productions and frankly aren't very cheap. But sometimes, you don't need to spend hundreds of dollars or travel hours away to see great music or party hard. Of course, if you're from Vancouver, you probably already know this. Because you have music waste. Every June, for 4 days and $15, all you need to do is hop on your bike and bounce around from venue to venue. That's it. That's music waste. And for Vancouver's music community, it's kind of become this unofficial kickoff to summer. But there's a lot more to it than that. Music waste comes from a true anti-establishment sentiment born out of a sarcastic discontent with corporate music and their sponsors. There's a spirit to this festival that's rooted in history and has allowed for it to survive for 20-plus years, outliving many of the big-box competitors that it was created to protest against.
For me, I think Music Waste is this space that is very unique to Vancouver.
This is Eleanor Waring. She's a coordinator for Music Waste.
Because the festival doesn't take itself too seriously and because it's kind of volunteer-run and most of the bands are really relaxed that are playing it as well, when stuff does go wrong or something happens with a venue or something has to shift, everybody kind of really has this can-do attitude where they're like, yep, okay, we're just gonna, that doesn't work, so we're gonna see what are our other options, like who can I call in for favors, like, and because everybody loves Music Waste, they're often very willing to help and to kind of overcome those hurdles.
And that's the big takeaway from Music Waste, the message from the community to itself. Don't take yourself too seriously. Now, when the original started in 1994, this was the idea. It was to push back against a festival that did take itself far too seriously and forced people to kind of bump elbows and pay to play. Initially, it was a one-off, but then it started to grow. After a couple years of hiatus, this festival was revisited again in the new millennium. This is Dustin Bromley. He used to be a coordinator for Music Waste.
So, as I understand it, there was New Music West, which was, very, let's say, corporation-funded, and, you know, there's a lot of your Nickelback-style bands, your radio rock bands, and apparently their selection process was a little more, elite, or they were definitely going after a certain sound, very, very just, like, easy on the ears, and these bands, as it's been told, we're doing things that have been done, you know, thousands of times before. Cool. And a group of people started a one-day festival called Music Waste, which, as I mentioned, is a big, big middle finger to the sky to New Music West. And in subsequent years, it expanded to a multiple-day festival.
But it really wasn't until the revival in 2004 that Music Waste became the festival that we would recognize it as today. This is Sarah Cordingley. She's one of the people that was around Music Waste at the time of its rebirth.
I was an intern at the Terminal City Weekly magazine, and some of the people there, in particular, John Cow, who was the music editor at the Terminal City at the time, and Darren Atwater, who was the editor, they sort of remembered or thought back nostalgically about Music Waste and thought they should resurrect it, and they I believe they actually talked to Chris Wood, who was one of the original organizers. They bought it from him for $50 or something, or maybe even less. And they sort of took it over. And the first year was really successful and really fun, and to me really sort of embodied exactly what it was meant to be, where it was sort of just chaos and everyone was just organizing it out of the good of their hearts and no one was really making any money.
While New Music West no longer existed, the ideals did. The idea that networking, self-promotion, and presentation were more important than the artistry behind the music was and still is a point of frustration within the Vancouver scene. During her time at Terminal City and then Only Magazine, Sarah and her team actively tried to disrupt superficiality through music waste and its promotion.
We often wrote sort of silly reviews of the bands that were, again, meant to just not take it too seriously. And who wants to read, you know, 85 band descriptions that are all just like talking about how great they are and how they're the next so-and-so, or, you know, how they're breaking boundaries and coming up with a new sound. It just seemed more fun to kind of make up funny stuff or tell, you know, funny stories that we knew about them. We were just so sick of bands trying to sell themselves to us, I guess.
Now, the festival's approach to actively pushing back against industry norms wasn't necessarily shared across the local scene. Bands trying to propel themselves beyond Vancouver work hard to cultivate image and press kits and didn't appreciate being called out for it.
Some of them were offensive, actually, I should say, in retrospect, that some of them were really too far and were just like vulgar and awful and rude. And some of them were maybe too true and were sort of actually poking fun at people. Something weird happened that was sort of a protest to music waste. And I think what happened was, this must have been in 2005 or six, and it was at the Columbia or Mike's Tavern. But the band, the Book of Lists, were boycotting. And then for some reason at the last minute, they decided to just like hijack a show and play. So we just like got a bunch of texts that that they were setting up at the show. And I don't know, maybe they were friends with the other bands that were playing, but they like set up and played a short set. And Cam and I like biked down there as quick as we could to watch them. And it was like kind of great because it was, you know, they were sort of mad at us or they were sort of doing it as a protest or something. But we thought it was really great and it was really kind of fun to have a surprise or to have, you know, a show sort of be sabotaged in a way that resulted in people getting to see a great band.
But this don't take yourself too seriously attitude fueled the largest criticism of the festival, artistic elitism.
Antagonism sort of between some bands or some artists and what they perceive as like some sort of snobby or elite group of people who are putting this on. But I think that's just based on a misconception that these people are being snobby or elitist because they do have to choose a limited number of bands.
There are times that we have to make a decision and say, okay, no, this band has played quite a few years in a row and we should give that spot to a new up-and-coming act. In the most part, I find that in the general spirit of the festival, bands are very supportive and kind of manage that themselves even.
Although Music Waste does frequently see many of the same faces, the turnover is fairly regular. During his tenure on the committee, Mark Richardson was tasked with scheduling the festival and recognized the emergence of new, younger acts.
Because Music Waste, they take a lot of chances on newer bands and younger bands. There's obviously a lot of familiar faces that you'll see from years past, but there's always try to make sure that there are new younger bands being selected each year, and that draws in their fan base or their friends. So I think if you do that year after year, you're just going to keep drawing in new people.
There was not enough infrastructure for emerging and weird local bands to sort of showcase themselves in a sustainable way, and I think that the more you support musicians, the more musicians support you. And historically, we've tried to be as inclusive as possible and allow people to have music waste shows, like to put on their own shows if they can find a venue and make it happen if they didn't get in. And we tried to support them with as much promotion as possible if they were willing to accept passes.
In making music more available and more accessible, Music Waste has opened the door to the community and has allowed artistic integrity to remain at the forefront of the scene rather than who you know or how much money you have.
Music Waste has consistently been very inexpensive, so the passes are $15, and that, if you think about the fact that in the past 20 years, like, everything has gotten more expensive in the world, the fact that it has remained this low price is incredibly remarkable. It's really important to everybody to keep it inexpensive, so I don't see that changing anytime soon, or at all. I don't see that changing ever. Actually, I think Music Waste would probably stop existing before it got more expensive.
This is the commitment Music Waste has made to Vancouver. But, like, whatever. Music provided by Future Star, Devours, and Pavel. You can find them and a whole bunch of other bands from Vancouver on Bandcamp. Thanks to CGSF 90.1 FM, and special thanks to Eleanor Waring, Dustin Bromley, Mark Richardson, and Sarah Cordingley. I'm Jamie Sesford. Thanks for listening.
Mixtape is not lost. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.